Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Experiment. Try something new. Create it in a really small bubble. And I know this probably gets said by 50% of your guests, but it's so important because your team, your people can't be what they can't see. So if they're not seeing you trying things, learning as you're going, working out loud, all of those kind of things, they're not going to do that themselves. And you're just kind of in a bit of a long road to ruin, I suppose, in terms of where your organization, your business goes.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. And I hope you enjoyed my recent conversations with Kate Adams of Drift and with Mike Montague of Sandler Training. I'm really excited to have today as my guest on the InnovaBuzz podcast, Steph Clark. Steph is a team transformation facilitator and also host of Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast. Steph was that kid who would hide under the covers with a torch reading until well past her bedtime, which is something that I can relate to because that's what I did as well. So I was fascinated to talk to her about all things facilitation, team culture, and, of course, books. A quick promotional message from our sponsor. That's my business, InnovaBiz. We help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal clients. Now, to help you get real clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can build a strong and enduring relationship with them, take a look at our Marketing Master mini class. It's just two modules, and in less than 30 minutes, you can get absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an enduring, engaging relationship. You can even use the exercise to define an ideal audience for a podcast, a speech, or a presentation, and perhaps even an ideal team member when you're hiring. Access the Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It is completely free, and you can get access without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Steph talked to me about team culture and measuring team performance. She explained that building and sustaining culture is really dependent on the stories that we tell ourselves. And we talked about the power of learning and discovery through books. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Steph Clark. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited today to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast from Melbourne, Australia, just near where I am, Steph Clark, who's a team transformation facilitator, and she also hosts Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast. I had to be very careful there because that's kind of a mouthful. Welcome to the podcast, Steph. It's a great privilege to have you as a guest.
Thanks very much. Yeah, imagine trying to say that every week when you're recording the podcast.
Yes. Yeah, you're probably a lot better at it than I am, though. Now, Beck Lloyd of Rowboat, who was our guest on episode 127, suggested that we have a conversation with you on the InnovaBuzz podcast. So big hello to Steph. From Steph to Beck.
Yep. Hi, Beck. Beck and I stalk each other, so we've got quite a good relationship going at the moment.
Great. Yeah, and we had a lot of fun talking with her about all things culture and how that played out in the corporate environment. Now, as a facilitator and team coach, you work with teams to identify and work on the behaviours and strategies to help make them more successful and also to keep them on track. So I'm really looking forward to digging deeper into some of that some more today, as well as learning about some of the fabulous books you've read and profiled on the Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast. But before we get on to all that, you've got an interesting background. You started out life, professional life, as an accountant, and you decided that crunching numbers wasn't exactly what you wanted to do, and you got a lot more buzz out of working with people. So what led you to make that transition that kind of seems like almost polar opposites? And is there something from the accounting background that kind of inspired you to do the work you do today?
It's probably one of the most common questions I get around how I made that move, because like you said, it always seems like such a polar opposite one to the other, from accounting or auditing into team development and more the personal or the human side of businesses and organizations. But it was strange, because at the time, and still now for me, it feels like it was an incredibly natural move, and probably because of the way I did it. So I actually started as an accountant, as an auditor, when I was 18. So I went straight from school into accounting, into one of the big four, and did all my training. And probably within about 12 to 18 months, realized that accounting and auditing really wasn't going to be what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, or even for the short to medium term of my career, for various reasons. But at the same time, I really enjoyed the discipline, I suppose, and the structure of the framework and the career path that was there for that initial part. So I definitely don't regret that start of my career. But what I really loved about it, which pivoted probably nicely into, or supplements nicely into what I do now, is learning about businesses, learning about the organization, learning about what was going on. And I would probably be the one, when I was interviewing clients, was asking them probably a bit more about, well, what does that mean for that person? Or how does that work? And thinking about the process and the systems and the dynamics a little bit more. And that was the bit I was always interested in. And then at the end of the conversation, I'd be like, oh, yeah, and how do you account for that? I'd have to remember I actually had a job, another job to do. So quite early on, because I joined one of the big four, they had very good training programs in place for junior accountants and obviously through your career. So quite early on, I went to one of these training courses and saw that people like me, who had gone through that path in the first 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years of their career, were there in front teaching at the front of the room. And I thought, well, that looks way more fun. Teaching the accounting and the auditing looks much more fun than actually doing the stuff. So within, like I said, the first 12 to 18 months, I set my sights for the next couple of years in joining the learning and development team and designing and developing and delivering technical training. So that's how I started. So it was actually a very natural progression as I went from doing the technical work into training and designing the training for technical accountants. And then from there, it really just, I don't know, just kind of got a bit out of hand, I suppose, and I just kept doing it. It escalated from there, and I moved from starting to move away from some of the technical training and more into the leadership type training, or soft skills as it still was in those days, and into some of the other areas that help make people more rounded professionals rather than just technical experts. And then really decided, or realized probably in the last 4 to 5 years, that I really love the team element of that. So it started to focus more on helping teams become better teams rather than not just individuals become better accountants or auditors or leaders or whatever it was.
That's a fascinating journey. So and at what point did you decide to start the podcast? Because I know I read something about you earlier that you, as a kid, you were with your torch under the covers after your official bedtime reading books. And I thought, that sounds really familiar, because I used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
So when did you decide that passion for reading was something that you wanted to share with others through the podcast?
It was podcasting had probably from the beginning, late 2017, early 2018, was probably in my mind as something I wanted to do, because I love the medium. I think there's so much opportunity there, and I just love the creativity and the options and the flexibility of it. So I always knew that I was going to be doing some kind of podcast. And initially I thought, well, it'll probably be something around culture or teams or leadership or something. And yeah, that's all very well and good. And I like talking about those things. But I thought, well, what sort of sits alongside that is something that I'm doing anyway. And it wasn't until I went to a conference in Brisbane, my second favourite Australian city, last year, which is called We Are Podcasts, which is an Australian podcast conference. And it started, and I went there knowing, again, I was going to do a podcast, but didn't know still what it was about. And there was something there, and I can't even really remember or put my finger on it, but it was something there that the two things kind of collided, my reading habit and my love of it, plus the podcasting. I thought, actually, let's put those together. And while we're talking about innovation, I know we've got some questions, we'll be talking about this as we go through. I think the greatest innovation comes when you smash two ideas together, or two fields, or two industries, or two people, to start thinking about how you combine different things into one thing.
Hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I like how you approach the book. So you kind of have almost three episodes with each book. So there's one where you kind of deconstruct the book and give three key messages that you took out of the book and talk a little bit about what the aim of the author was in writing it. And then you do another one that is like a conversation starter. So how could you take those lessons into a team cultural environment? And then later on you do a 10 key points, is it? 10 key points from the last 10 book episodes or something like that. So you certainly kind of repackage it in a lot of different ways, which I really like.
Got to leverage that content. Yeah.
So with the cultural team training that you do, what are the things that you work on? What are the changes that you bring about or help people to bring about in their organisations and in themselves?
There's various different things, and I think some of the greatest themes I see, or the most common themes, is probably around how to create shared language in teams. So that might be around a challenge that everyone is facing, and it's the elephant in the room, and we need to actually bring it out, welcome the elephant into the room and give it a name and say, this is elephant, this it is, the problem is, or the elephant is this, and name it and give it some language that then people can use to start to pull it apart and start to think, well, why is that happening, etc. So that's probably one of the things I see quite a lot. But a lot of the times that's not why people are coming to me. So when I have those initial calls or emails or conversations with people, they're diagnosing a symptom, or they're feeling or seeing a symptom, but that's not often actually the problem. And when we dig a little bit deeper, we generally find that there's either some kind of elephant in the room, there's a trust issue, there's some problems with how people are being measured, rewarded, recognised, etc. And I was talking to a group a few months ago now, and we sort of all sat down. Within the first 5 minutes, they'd said, oh, you know, we've got this problem with our team. They spend all their time doing these things and none of their time doing those things. And they wanted them to be doing, you know, the B, the second part of that. And I said, oh, okay, well, how are you measuring people? What are they being measured on? Is it the things A or things B? And there was this kind of awkward look in the room and some scribbling of some notes as they discussed that actually, no, we're measuring people for the things they're doing. And funnily enough, that's how they're spending their time. So we sometimes dig into the weeds and even into things like, I've spent hours of time and probably days, if you put it all together, of time with teams reconstructing their meetings, from their agendas to the cadence to who's there, to actually decide, well, if these things that you're saying are important are actually important, why are we never talking about them? Why are they not the top thing of the agenda or the meeting agendas, the leadership team meeting that we are having, if these are supposedly very important topics? So someone's getting down into the, my big ambition is to change how work works, because I don't think work, or the concept of work, works very well. So sometimes by digging into how teams work and the ecosystem that they exist in and the other parts that affect how people behave, is really important. And actually, that's probably where I've been spending a lot of time. But sometimes that's quite unexpected when people kind of come to me and they're having those initial conversations. They're not expecting we're spending half a day going through their leadership meeting agendas and completely turning it upside down and starting again. But then at the same time, they're getting great results from doing that. So it's an interesting balance and an interesting question around what the challenges are, because I think fundamentally the challenge is that how people are working is not working. And the outcome of that is various things around some toxic cultures, some behavioral weirdness, people working in silos, all of those kind of different things is how it's playing out.
Yeah, it's fascinating. As soon as you get a bigger organization, how that silo thing seems to kick right in, even in organizations where, you know, you think there's a really innovative culture and there's a culture of cooperation, and yet somehow that just seems to happen. I haven't quite worked out why that is. But
you say that, but then I was talking to someone very recently, organization of 2.5 people, the half person does about 10 hours a week just as a bit of a contractor and on some admin. They've got silos. They've got a silo problem, and there's
really?
Three people or 2.5 people, three people, obviously, yeah. Three humans, but in terms of time in the business. And I just thought, there is literally no hope for anyone if we can't even get this right in an organization of three people.
That's right. That's actually pretty impressive. You can construct silos in such a small group.
And there's, came down to it's a design problem.
So do you kind of look at first principles then and say, well, how is the culture of that organisation right at the sort of first principle and fundamental level that then underpins an organisation that doesn't have those silos, or where people, you know, maybe there are nominal silos in terms of job descriptions or functions, but that they're not barriers to people working together across those functions?
Yes. So I'd say, yes, getting back to those first principles is really important. Sometimes that's not possible, because I think everything's possible in some ways. But if I'm working with a team who exists within a very large or very complex or very antiquated organization, sometimes you've got to kind of work with what you can work with and control what you can control. So yes, whilst I'd like to get in and actually like tear it all apart in terms of how their whole, you know, the whole structure works, various reasons, that's not always possible. So sometimes you've got to leave the first principles or come back to that in a way that you can control, which might be not the ideal, but it's going to move things forward in the right direction until there's the appetite or the readiness or the maturity or whatever to really make things work.
So how do you go about starting those conversations around, you know, let's say that there's something that's the elephant in the room, which, as you mentioned, is building up a barrier to trust between people or between departments. How do you open up those conversations?
For me, one of the really important things is if I'm going to go into a room and go there a little bit with a group, you know, again, depending on scale and number of the people in that room, the first thing I have to do before we even get to the room is build the trust with the people. So again, depending on numbers, but I'll usually try and have a phone call, if not some other interaction, with each person who's going to be in that workshop. Is really important, particularly if we are going to go there, but just to have that initial piece so they start to get over that hurdle of, well, do we even trust this random woman with the red glasses who's walked into the into the room? So that's really important, first of all, because I've got to build that trust before they can then trust me, and then they can trust the process and trust the conversation we're going to have. That then also usually unlocks some other stuff, whatever that may be, that's going on as well. And I just hear the language that people are using, and then I can design some kind of session or conversation around that. And sometimes that happens in a group, depending on, again, on numbers and scale. Sometimes that will happen in some small groups. Sometimes we'll do some individual reflection and use some tools like Menti to get some words up on the board so that everyone can see, oh, actually, I'm not alone. And I think that's the other really important point quite early on in that process, in the actual workshop, is to make people realise that they're not feeling those things on their own. So then that then opens up the conversation. Sometimes I'll leave that as quite an emergent thing to then go with, depending on where the conversation goes in the room, and I'll facilitate from there. Sometimes it is a bit more structured, depending if we know, I suppose, what the outcome is that we're really looking for, but also getting the team to define it, again, in their own words, or the group to define in their own words, what does good look like? Because it's all very well saying, oh, none of this stuff's working, but if you don't actually know what you want or what that could look like, it's hard to really get into fixing or changing anything.
Yeah, beginning with the end in mind. I love
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned earlier about, you know, the one example where people were measuring the thing that they actually didn't want to happen. So that's clearly a way to check, well, let's find out what you actually want, and let's really define that clearly. Let's get everybody articulating that, and then everybody understanding what that looks like. And then that gives you a reasonable chance of getting people aligned towards that goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another really important question that I'll ask somewhere during the process is, how is any of this being measured? Because if it's not, there's probably no point us doing that workshop.
Hmm. All right. So what are some of the most challenging situations you've encountered then in that environment where you've come in to facilitate team meetings or team outcomes?
One of them would be leadership teams that are just far too big. It's probably one of the most painful things I find in some of the work I do, and is leadership teams which are 15, 18, 20 plus people sometimes. And you just think, number one, this isn't a team, because how can it be? This is far too many people. And I suppose part of that is silos as well, because generally a lot of these people are some kind of department leaders, and they're all there for, you know, as a head of department, or, you know, again, whatever the structure is, they're all in their own little silo or field or vertical. So then you've got to try and break that down. So that's really challenging in terms of leadership teams that are too big. Now, obviously, there's some really great and interesting work there around redesigning some of that and redesigning models, etc., which is pretty interesting. And that's really, really good, interesting work, and usually quite meaningful and effective work as well. The other thing I've found in some of the work I've done that's been really challenging is leaders that aren't on board. So I've gone into a few workshops, and you can tell very quickly that it's a token. It's a token person, bring an external in. And that's come down, you know, and again, I've learned from that in terms of asking the right questions up front. And the leaders are in and out of the room, which then sets the tone around other people, for other people in the room. And then they start being in and out of the room. And you just kind of think, actually, this, I'm not here to actually change anything. I'm not here to make any kind of difference or any kind of impact. I'm here because they had a bit of extra money to spend in their, you know, workshop budget or their offsite budget or their retreat budget, and they wanted an external facilitator. Now, like I said, some of that I've definitely learned some lessons from around making sure I've got have those calls with the leaders, and not always trusting that the person who's hiring me, or however you want to phrase that, depending on the contract and the context, but whoever's hiring me actually fully always understands the dynamics or how other people are going to respond to that session. So that's definitely been some lessons I've learned, and been some of the more challenging ones I've had is when some of the people who are in the room aren't bought in. And I can deal with that to a large extent, but again, it's knowing that in advance and doing the legwork to make sure that's managed.
Yeah. Well, that's always a challenging situation. I mean, for a start, it disrupts whatever work you're going to do, because it's kind of holding people back and drawing attention to an individual rather than to the problem at hand or the issue that you're working on. And also it undermines your kind of authority as the person that's come in and to open their eyes to better ways of doing things.
Now, at the same time, sometimes that actually works in my favour, because it starts to really show the issues that exist. But the problem is then when there's, it's the workshop you know, for whatever reason, the time's not available to actually really get into, because then you start to really see what's going on. You're like, oh, this isn't, you know, cannot deal with this in an hour and a half. This is not going to work, which is why generally, you know, and I work with teams, it tends to be for a series or for a period of time, which again means you can get that bit deeper and actually really get some change. And often I'll say to clients, well, I can come in and do a half day or a couple of hours, but I'll be here in 6 months or in a year doing the same thing, because fundamentally nothing's really going to change from that. So it feels sometimes like quite a scary conversation, but it's a real one. I mean, that sort of works great for annuity revenue, but not great for the soul or for actually making a difference, which is why we're all here, I'm sure.
Well, it kind of reminded me of the question we'll ask later about keeping a project or client on track. But clearly an hour and a half workshop might teach you something, but it's not like bringing about a fairly big cultural change, particularly in teams where there's silos there, and that there's sort of a fairly big change to happen there. That's not going to happen in one session or overnight. And even if they do get it in that one session, there's still a whole lot of steps to be taken to kind of change.
But you can, I mean, like I said, you can start a very good conversation in an hour and a half or something like that. But you can't just leave it there. That's the problem. It starts to open up and crack things open. But leaving it there is usually not much help. But it makes it just bring up some awareness. But then you've got to do something with it afterwards.
Yeah. All right. Now, I know you've, we talked briefly about podcasting. You've gotten into podcasting with your book, your learning passion and book reading passion. And I know that we talked earlier before we started recording about using podcasting as a medium that you might be able to use internally as well. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is another one of those examples where you mentioned earlier about bringing two things together, allowing two ideas to crash into one another. So tell me a little bit more about what your thinking is there. How does that fit into the cultural change work you're doing? How does the podcasting part come into it?
So something I'm experimenting with at the moment as a bit of a service offering, should we say, is around helping organizations design and think about using internal podcasts. Because like I said earlier, the medium is incredible in terms of its flexibility, its accessibility, creativity, all of the rest, to think about, well, actually, how do we start telling our culture story outside of just the people I sit next to in the office, and particularly where teams are becoming more diverse, more dispersed. You've got remote workers, you've got flexible workers, you've got people who are in and out because they're on the road. How do they still feel part of your organization? And all of its culture is built and broken often through the stories in terms of what people are seeing, hearing, telling each other, sharing, etc. So a big part of it, and big part of the power of podcasting, is being able to do that at scale and in a very easy way. The other thing as well is, you know, we're hearing and seeing more and more and more that emails are just the dirge of work and aren't really working for many people. Again, very well, this, you know, emails are great, but there is a limit in terms of how many we can actually process. So, and really, are you getting the same connection by sending another company-wide mass email out to everyone around, you know, the country, the world, the office, whatever it is, compared to the one-on-one medium that is podcasting? Because podcasting, most people, the vast majority of people, in fact, listen on their own and generally in headphones, wearing headphones. So again, you've got a very personal connection with someone when you're podcasting or when you're talking to them via a podcast, which is more personal and you can share more and it's much more flexible. It's also easier for people to digest and consume because they can do it on the go whilst they're commuting, etc. Which then links to the other point, which, especially given my background in learning and development, one of the things that I heard a lot is people saying, well, I want to, you know, do this course or whatever, but the company's learning management system, the LMS, or whatever platform people are using to distribute content internally can only be used on my laptop, on the network, in the office, or some crap like that, which in 2019 just still infuriates me that that's a problem. Whereas internal podcasts, even secure ones, which are protected in various ways can be delivered in a secure way, but in a very flexible way so people can get it on their phones, on the move, while they're doing other things.
Hmm. Yeah, it certainly is a very flexible medium. And as you say, a lot of people are listening to podcasts while they're doing other things. So I imagine it'd be great for those that are travelling quite a lot because they've got dead time waiting in queues. They've got long drives. They might have
flights. You can download them for flying. Mm. And again, it's sometimes, as someone who's travelled quite a lot with work and pretty regularly in previous roles, again, you can become quite disconnected quite quickly from who your team or your client or your organisation is even. Particularly, I know, working with people, consultants in particular, who maybe spend 12, 18, 24 months out at client sites, and they get this weird kind of Stockholm syndrome where they forget who they're actually, you know, they become more affiliated almost with the client than they do with their own organization, which is very understandable. It's a very human thing because that's who you're seeing all the time. But again, wouldn't podcasts be a great way of still connecting them so that they feel part of the organization that they're actually employed by?
That's great. It reminded me, I used to travel a lot in my corporate role. Probably 30 to 40% of my time I was traveling and out interstate or in another country, and I'd often come home and there'd be somebody in my office sitting there and working in the office because it was sort of well known that office wasn't used that much, and somebody would be there and I'd come back in, and I'd always make this joke about, oh, do I have a job yet? Do I have a job to come back to?
I think everyone's just feeling very jealous that you had an office, given the state of open plan workplaces, etc.
Well, look, this is a little while ago, so probably today they'd take the office straight away. But it was kind of symptomatic of what you said, that there's a certain disconnect that comes about from that when you're spending all the time. I mean, I was with clients a lot of the time. I was with teams, so I had remote teams that I was running, but then, you know, you weren't actually at location to pick up on all the little stuff that was going on day to day, and all of a sudden there'd be some big thing that happened, which wasn't really a big thing because people that were there saw all the little events that led up to that and came along for the journey, whereas those that were away all of a sudden were like, oh, what's going on here?
How did that happen? Yeah. And again, even with the learning things, again, podcasts can be used, because that's the other problem is generally with learning, and particularly internal organizational learning, is people, it's hard to find actually what you're looking for a lot of the time. So again, podcasts can be a really great way of breaking down learning into bite-sized chunks. It's very up-to-date and relevant. You're not waiting 2 years for some instructional designer somewhere to design the perfectly textbook course that's, you know, very, it's got all the assessments in and all the right language around learning objectives, etc. But actually, you can get those bite-sized chunks of updates, etc., from a technical perspective, but also more of a cultural perspective too, on the go.
It's definitely a huge potential there, I think, for that sort of thing. And when I think back to my corporate days, I mean, training was always a big deal. And like you say, then, you know, there'd be a need identified for a particular training or a skill set or something, and then it'd take ages either to identify an external provider that had all the stuff ready to go and present, or for somebody to put together this fancy course that was then either delivered in person or through the internet on a learning system that was hard to access, like you said, that you had to sort of go back to the office on the computer to get to sit down and do it. And when you were back in the office on the computer, you didn't have time to do it.
Solves all the problems.
All right. I'm curious, with your Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast, how do you select the books to feature on that? Is it just what you happen to be reading right now, or do you have a system where you're actually selecting books going forward for future episodes?
At the moment, I'm working through mostly the books that I read last year. So 2018, I read about 30 odd books. So I'm still luckily got a bit of a backlog that I'm working through books that I have read, which is very helpful. And I'm very worried about when that runs out, I catch up with myself and I'm going to have to be binge reading every week to be able to put a podcast out. So that's very stressful to think about. But so at the moment, that's how I'm doing it. However, when new books come out from a kind of marketing perspective from the podcast, it's very useful to catch up and do something like, so earlier this year when the new Mark Manson book came out, which is the follow-up to The Subtle Art of Not Giving a You Know What. So yeah. the follow-up is called Everything Is. Are we allowed to swear on here? Do we just be blanked out? I don't know.
Yeah, we're probably right, everything shouldn't is do F'd. It because I have marked it as yeah. We're starved.
Everything is F'd. There we go. So when that came out, I did read that pretty quickly after it came out, which again is just a good way of advertising the podcast and stuff off of something that people are talking about anyway. So I do a bit of a mixture between books that I'm reading at the moment or have read quite recently. And again, particularly if there's a particular zeitgeist around something, then I'll think, well, I've read a book about that, so maybe that's a good timing for this one now. Again, things like habit building, productivity ones, I try and do towards the beginning of the year because it's when people are thinking about those things, or new financial year as well, particularly here in Australia. I think sometimes the new financial year feels like a bigger deal than the actual new calendar year. So there's some things like that to play with that I do think about in terms of the scheduling. But generally, it is just working through the backlog. And again, just making sure I'm not doing 8 biographies in a row or something like that. So getting a good variety through them. And in terms of then choosing books now, so obviously the ones I read were the ones I read because I had them or I like the author. But often now, especially now I've read quite a lot of books, you start to see the same ones being referenced in other books. So thinking, I've seen this one come up so many times. So Anti-Fragile is one that I've seen mentioned in a number of books. So I thought, I should probably read that at some point. So I bought that one. And then other books that obviously just now people talk to me about books a lot more. So they're always recommending books or sending me books as well. So that tends to fill up my pipeline quite a lot.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. There's a few podcasts out. I think there's one, the Marketing Book Podcast, if I remember correctly, and they do one book a week, and it's one guy, and he sometimes has the author on to interview. But I've always wondered, how do you run a business and at the same time read one business book a week in the depth required to actually go on a podcast and tell somebody else the key messages and do a bit of an analysis. Because to me, that's a pretty major project to do all of that inside of a week.
Well, the two Adams from This Is What I Learned, who do a slightly longer form version of my podcast, well, not of mine, they were there first, but of the podcast that's similar to mine, but slightly different. And they do a mixture of interviews with the author, and they do, like I said, they do slightly longer form ones. They read a book a week between them. They read the book.
Yeah, that's right.
And I do, and I've caught up with Adam Ashton, and I was like, how on earth do you do that? Because I read pretty quickly and I can consume a lot of book in a short period of time, but not every week for a year because, life happens and all the rest. But at the same time, what I've done to try and counter some of that, and also some books just take longer to read, like Sapiens or anything by Noah Yuval Harari. It's just phenomenal how long that would take. I'm currently reading something called Immunity to Change, which is a very academic book, and I pretty much need to have a nap after every page. So again, those books will take me probably a month to get through, but even reading consistently and all the rest, whereas others I can smash out in an afternoon or certainly in a weekend. But for that reason, for this year, and I've started doing 2 reading weeks a year where I go away and all I do, the only thing on my agenda, is reading and some exercise, because I can't just sit around for a week. I'm not that person. But so we went to, my boyfriend and I went to Bali for a week in June, because we live in Australia and that's what we do now. We have to go to Bali on holiday. And I just read. So I read. Yeah, exactly. Done that now. It took us 5 years to get there. So I felt like we weren't too cliche. But all I did was read. I read 5 books in the sort of 5 days that we were there, which was good. So I'm going to do that a couple of times a year as well, which again, if you can read 10 books over those 2 weeks, then I'd be pretty happy with that as a bit of adding to the log.
And I see you're a big fan of Blinkist as well. So I haven't actually met anybody before that was a fan of Blinkist. I was one of their beta testers, and I just love their service. I'm surprised they haven't started a book podcast.
Yeah, I was actually wondering that just a few weeks ago. I mean, I've got out of the habit of using it as much because I'm reading a lot more. But probably 2 years ago, actually, I started using Blinkist because a colleague of mine had recommended it and found it really useful. I do still use it every so often, particularly if someone mentions a book to me and I want to kind of know enough to be dangerous to know enough. And also sometimes just to think. And a number of times on Blinkist, I've looked at a book, got the key ideas and thought, either that's enough, I probably don't need to read the whole thing. That sometimes books can be summarized in those 10 blinks or 12 blinks or whatever it is. But other times I've read it and thought, actually, I need more on that. So I will buy the book. A couple of people have referred to my podcast, which I'm very flattered by, as the kind of the human Blinkist or the podcast Blinkist. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much how I use Blinkist to look at new books and then decide, gee, that's interesting. I think I want to get the book and dig deeper. Mm. Or like you say, that's enough. I think I've got the message. And I also use it to go back to books I've read in the past just as a bit of a refresher.
Yeah, and that's what I found it actually really useful for as well, is to do those refreshes, particularly of books I read maybe at the beginning of last year or even the year before I go back to do the notes. Sometimes just to, and whilst the Kindle app is very good, particularly on the iPad, less so on the actual Kindle, to actually go back and just skim through the book, because a lot of the books I read are ebooks or Kindle books. Blinkist is really good to go, oh yeah, I remember that one, I remember that story, I remember that example or whatever, to help make my notes.
All right, well, this is fascinating. I could go on talking about podcasting and books and culture and all those things for ages, but I'm aware of the time, so I think it's a good point to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's a series of five questions for our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five, as I said, questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that will inspire our audience to go and do something awesome today.
No pressure.
That's right. What do you think the number one thing is anyone can do to be more innovative?
It's going to be very cliche given what we've just been talking about, but I would say read. I'd say read and learn. And learn not just from your own field, but particularly learn and listen to things or talk to people from other fields. So looking across to other disciplines, industries, types of people, whatever it is, countries even, is probably the thing that I would say would be the number one thing.
Yeah, that's great advice. And a few of our guests have said things like that recently, you know, going to a different country or going to a trade show in an industry that's totally unrelated to what you're in. So that's a similar bit of advice. And I think there's, you know, that's another way of doing what you said earlier about bringing two ideas from kind of separate areas together as an innovation. Yep. So what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Paused and thought, because it's very hard, and I know, and I'm really bad at this, and I need to, and I was listening to just a podcast just this morning, actually talking about this with Amantha Imber and Sayan Taid, which was a really great podcast on Amantha. Am I allowed to talk about other podcasts on your podcast? Amantha Imber's How I Work podcast.
Yeah, we had Amantha on a couple of episodes ago, so.
Oh, great. Oh, yes. I think I saw that, actually. Anyway, so she was talking about giving yourself space, or Sam was talking about giving yourself space. It's something I'm really bad at, but I know that that is exactly when I do come up with my better ideas, is when I'm not consuming, which I pretty much always am, but I'm sat thinking. And it's been really interesting now running my own business and being out for nearly 6 months on my own completely. I was doing it on the side of my corporate role for about 15 months before that, and just the absence of stuff, because in a corporate role there's always stuff, isn't there? There's always stuff to do. Most of it, a large percentage of it though, is low value, if any value. It's all just internal gumph. But it takes up time and space and brain power. But not having that now in my business, obviously there's always admin to do and things like that, but not to the same scale. I'm finding myself with a bit more free time, which is excellent. So it's thinking about how you use space to create your better ideas, or to let your better ideas happen, probably is probably a better way of putting it.
Yeah. All right. That's great. And yeah, getting out of the day-to-day stuff is always good to let the brain recover and start to think about things that are outside the boundaries.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you have a favourite resource that you use a lot?
The internet? Yeah. I think it's going to something like Spotify, actually, because the other thing for me is music is a huge part of my day and my life. So using Spotify and finding the right music for the different work I'm doing is a great way of stimulating different thought, different moods, different energy levels in what I'm doing of a day. So I would actually say music, and so Spotify. And also now that they've got a much better podcast app or podcast player on there, then Spotify is going to continue to take over the world. So that probably would be my number one.
Yeah, Spotify's really gone all guns blazing into podcasting, haven't they?
And I must say, I think they're doing it better than Apple has been in terms of the GUI and the consumer or the user experience. So it'd be interesting to see how Apple, when they change their layout of those things, how they respond.
And we launched a client podcast yesterday, and I went through all the directory submissions and Spotify, and I hadn't seen this happen before. Spotify was up almost instantly. As soon as we submitted it, it was there. Whereas most of the others take
days, you might not have seen this weeks. Yet. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I know people have waited 30 days for the Apple one to be processed. The other thing on Spotify is the demographic and the stats, the analytics you get is phenomenal in terms of your listeners. Like the Apple ones are pretty good, and on your hosting service they'll be pretty good too. But the Spotify ones, like, it shows you what music your typical listeners to, which I thought was because they've got that, you know, they've got that information. Yeah, I mean that's their jam. So I found that really interesting, and it turns out my listeners have the polar opposite music taste to me. But I can forgive them for that.
Yeah. All right.
They've got good taste in podcast, if not in music.
Yeah. So we did touch on this earlier. What's the best way to keep a client on track?
Schedule it. For me, I have to put my follow-ups and things in my own diary / with my clients if it's, you know, appropriate to have those kind of follow-up conversations on the regular. But for me, it is thinking, right, we've just had this workshop. How am I going to follow that up in 4 weeks' time? And it's simple things like obviously checking in how they're going, and particularly if you're sending really good output documents after a workshop or after a piece of work. I don't mean 100-page things. I mean, 3 or 4 or 5 pages of not too many words and lots of outputs and actions, etc. Following up on those specifically, asking what help they need, thinking about the next time, just getting those business updates from them as well. So doing that, and like I said, scheduling it to an appropriate time frame and agreeing that expectation with them so they know that you're going to be in touch and it'll be in a particular time. It's just kind of the simple stuff, but it's so easy to forget and think, oh God, I haven't spoken to that client for 6 weeks, and you know, we've got this other thing coming up, and all of a sudden it looks a bit rushed and last minute.
All right, that's great advice. Yeah, so scheduling the follow-ups and then kind of checking in on them relative to the last report essentially that you've given them.
Yeah.
All right, and what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
It's going to sound really broad and vague, but be themselves. And I think I was thinking about this just the other day. I was listening actually to another podcast. They were talking about this kind of thing is this, everything's been invented pretty much. Now, I'm sure I'll be proven wrong like tomorrow when some cool new thing comes out. But all the idea, like in terms of ideas, pretty much everything exists. So the only way you're going to do it differently is by getting really specific about micro niching, even, and I hate the term of niching that's so overused, but you know, it is important. But micro niching, but also just think about what is your edge that you bring to that, and it might not be from your work experience, even. It might be thinking about, again, colliding those skills from your personal experience or something else in your life or your background or your heritage or whatever it could be, or your gender. It could be a combination of different things that gives you a different perspective and a different slant on ideas or problems or solutions that probably already exist.
Yeah, that's really good advice, and it is tough for some people to kind of really grasp that, but I guess once they get it, I think it's very powerful. And I was chatting to a client this morning about their positioning. We're actually working on his ideal client modeled off one of his clients, and this client's client was an interior, or is an interior designer, and apparently very good at it, but she also has this passion to redesign people's mindsets around their life and, you know, the direction they're heading. And my client came up with the idea, hey, why don't you marry those two services to kind of work with clients who are looking for, you know, change, whether they're in midlife crisis or whether they're in a change of career and they need some guidance as to direction, you know, change of direction, how things are going, and take that and match their interior design to, okay, this is where you're now headed.
Oh, wow.
And let's make your environment match where you're headed so that everything's in alignment and you're feeling really great all the time, because the what you see outside you and what's inside your head is all aligned. And so I thought that was
a really neat way of kind
of being differentiated, because it was bringing together a couple of skills that she had and you know, that one passion in a way that wasn't necessarily obvious to her. And there's probably very few people that would do that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? And I think one of the challenges with those sort of things, and I think particularly if I can be so bold as to say that in somewhere like Australia, it's that first mover advantage can be a bit of a disadvantage, I think, because I've seen this in a couple of things that, you know, I've tried, but also other people around me have tried, is Australia isn't always, it's funny because it's so entrepreneurial, and I really love that about the Australian market, because everyone's out doing their own thing, and it's pretty collaborative as well. It's not too competitive in a really good way, but the quality is high. But in terms of the innovation or the appetite for new services that are quite radically different is quite low. There's a bit of a fear factor, I think, around some of those things, which I think that is one of the challenges or barriers to innovation a little bit in Australia. And maybe this is, you know, not unique to here, having this obviously my main experience more recently. So it is then that, right, how do I make that safe and easy for people to buy, and how do I relate it to something they already know? Because if they can't imagine what they're buying, and I even find that with some coaching type things, you know, with companies or individuals that aren't as mature in that area, even though coaching's been around for however long, still a bit of a challenge, because people are, oh, I don't really know what that feels like. so it's hard to sell.
Yeah. I agree with you that there does seem to be a reluctance in some of those areas to take a little bit of a risk, I guess. But in some ways, it just needs to be communicated better, I think, from the provider.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I think, you know, you touched on that about how they express it and how they paint a picture of what the outcome might be for their client.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Steph. This has been really great. Now, where can people reach out and find more about what you do, find out about Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast, and also even say thank you for what you shared with us today?
Yep. So I'm going to put all the links, I assume, in the show notes as well. But stephclark.com is probably my main business website, but I'm most active on LinkedIn. So Steph-Clark, if you search for that in LinkedIn, and also on Instagram, Steph_Clark_ Clark has an E on the end, by the way, and also Steph's Business Bookshelf on all good podcast providers.
Yeah, including Spotify.
Including Spotify, especially Spotify.
All right, well, now, what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation and in their field?
Experiment. try something new, create it in a really small bubble. And I know this probably gets said by 50% of your guests, but it's so important because your team, your people can't be what they can't see. So if they're not seeing you trying things, learning as you're going, working out loud, all of those kind of things, they're not going to do that themselves. And you're just kind of in a bit of a long road to ruin, I suppose, in terms of where your organization, your business goes.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, great advice. All right, and finally then, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Probably would say Mel Kettle, who has just restarted her podcast, The Connected Life, which is a very cool idea. And I was actually a guest on that a couple of weeks ago on episode 2. But she does some really interesting work with teams, and she's got this real theme of connection and created more connected leaders and organizations. So I think that would be a really nice supplement to the other, or to your, for your audience, but also for the messages that you're putting out on the podcast as well.
All right, great. Well, we'll an introduction from you to Mel and reach out to her to bring her on the show in the future.
Will do.
So thanks again, Steph, for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today. I've really enjoyed this and I've learned a lot about the work you do in teams, and it kind of brought back memories of some of the challenges we faced in my corporate days. Mm-hmm. Would have been nice to have you around then, but that's water under the bridge. And I'm really loving the Business Bookshelf podcast too, and how you're tackling that and repurposing a lot of the work you put into the initial episode on the book itself. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Will do. Thanks, Jürgen.
I hope you enjoyed that engaging and enlightening conversation with Steph and took something away from her episode. I love her approach to team performance, beginning with the end in mind and building culture based on that desired outcome. I'd love to know what you took away from Steph's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Steph Clark. That is STEPHCLARKE. All lowercase or one word, innovabiz.co/Steph Clark. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Steph there, as well as links to her website, her social media pages, to Steph's Business Bookshelf podcast, and to the other resources we spoke about in our conversation today. Steph suggested we have a conversation with Mel Kettle, a communication strategist, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. So Mel, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Steph Clark. And remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster to get absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery or our help with podcast production, then send me an email to jürgen@innovabiz.co and we'll set up a quick call just to get to know one another. Tune in again next week. We've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Jason Resnick of Res.com and George Bryant of GB Masterminds. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the Innova Buzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.